Welcome to the NPR Movie Podcast. Coming up, Terrence Howard sings for NPR Scott Simon. Director Oliver Stone chats about how there's a little bit of George Bush in all of us. And finally, NPR's Alex Cohen looks at Oliver Stone's 1987 movie Wall Street and how relevant it is today. But first, a conversation with Queen Latifah about how nervous she gets around bees and her character in The Secret Life of Bees.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Alyssa Block. The best-selling novel, The Secret Life of Bees by Sue Monk Kidd, is now a movie. Judging by the cast, you might think the movie adaptation is actually a musical. Three of its stars, Queen Latifah, Jennifer Hudson, and Alicia Keys, have successful music careers. But they, along with Sophie Okonedo and Dakota Fanning, manage a different kind of harmony in the film.
It's the story of a young white girl in 1960s South Carolina who runs away from her abusive father and winds up in the home and care of the three Boatwright sisters, all named for months of the year, May, June, and August. Queen Latifah plays August Boatwright, the eldest sister and the matriarch of the home. She runs a business making honey, and Queen Latifah joins me here in the Washington studio to talk about her role in this new film. So glad you're here.
Thank you for having me.
I'm just curious, given your name, Queen Latifah,
mm-hmm.
and a film about bees and honey, there must have been all kinds of jokes on the set about Queen Bee.
There was an occasion, yeah, one or two occasional jokes daily. Yeah,
daily, sure, yeah, I figured hourly probably. Did you see yourself initially as August, or was there another character that spoke to you?
I just always connected with August because this character is so nurturing and loving and confident and comfortable in her own skin, that she just seems at peace. She reminds me partially of my mom, and my grandmother's in there, and parts of me, you know. She's an entrepreneur. She owns her own land, and she's a big sister who's really more like a mother.
She lives in a big pank house.
Big old pank house.
P-A-N-K, pank.
Definitely.
You are the matriarch of the family. You help run the family business.
Mm-hmm.
Black Madonna Honey,
mm-hmm.
and you spend a lot of time with bees.
Mm-hmm.
And before we continue, I'd like to listen to a clip. This is a scene with you and Dakota Fanning, who plays Lily Owen, and mm-hmm. you're giving her some wisdom.
You see, the world's really just one big bee yard. The same rules work in both places. Don't be afraid, as no life-loving bee wants to sting you. But don't be an idiot. That's why we wear long sleeves and long pants. And don't swat. Don't even think about swatting. And above all, send the bees love. Every little thing wants to be loved.
And you set out to work there. Now, you are so calm and so poised in that scene.
Mm-hmm.
Are you normally that calm around bees?
No. No, absolutely not.
Do you have a secret fear of bees?
I don't have a fear of bees. I mean, I've been stung enough times, so I do have, I guess I have a fear of being stung, but actually I'm fascinated by bees. I just, the bees are going through a little something. they're struggling with this collapsed hive syndrome thing that's been going on with bees. But I just had to work with the beekeeper and learn more about them and just try to be as calm as I could. I was definitely nervous, though.
This film takes place in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get yourself in a 1960s mindset? How did you take yourself to 1964 South Carolina?
It's easy for me. I don't have to really be in the 60s to connect to it. I every time I try to hail a cab in New York and they pass me and pick up the white person that's further back than I am, then I get a dose of it. Or your mother not being able to get a home loan because she's black. You know, this is what I know that my family has experienced, and it made it more difficult for us until I was able to buy her that first house. But it only takes one experience for you to connect to that pain. It's painful.
Did you spend any time in the South?
Maryland, Virginia, yeah. I mean, not deep South, but I sort of grew up here, you know. So that's why I kind of felt like I related to this character even more. I feel like, you know, there's a lot of films where you get to see the angry side of racism, bigotry, the violent side of it, the blatant side of it. But, I mean, there's a different side of the South as well, a very hospitable side, a side that says, good morning, Miss Boatwright, and how you doing today, and how's that May doing? And this would be a white guy. You know, it'd just be when you wanted to sit down at a counter that you would see that that's an issue, that's a problem. But other than that, people sort of went about everyday life. And I felt like it was interesting to show that side of life. There were a lot of black people who owned their own homes and owned their own property, especially with segregation. There would be a lot more of black-owned businesses because who else are you going to deal with? It was just kind of nice to see that side of it, to see these people who own their property, they own their business, they're respected in their community. There are white people here who are straight up racist, and there are white people here who that want to see all this change. And I thought that was something that would make it a little bit different than what other things you may have seen.
How did you find each other as sisters? Because there's something very natural.
I think we just clicked immediately. I felt like I was their older sister. Because in a way, I mean, you know, I've been acting for a while. And, you know, Jennifer and Alicia are pretty new at it. Dakota's more experienced than all of us. She must have been here before, as they say.
Told so.
And Sophie is amazing, you know. But I'm the oldest. I've been doing this a while. Kind of be the example, sort of be a leader, being supportive. You all right? You need anything? We good? Keeping the spirit light, you know what I mean? Keeping no diva attitudes, like no pretentiousness.
Did you stay with the script? And there's a scene in the kitchen with the Jennifer Hudson, Sophie Okonedo are at the stove, and they're dancing. There's a song on the radio, and they're singing, and they're dancing, and they're flipping pancakes and making eggs.
I can't break away, you make me cry. I can't break away, I can't say goodbye.
You're kind of moving your head a little bit, but there's a sense that you want to get up and dance too, but you're the big sister, so you have to sit down at the head of the table. And I wondered if that scene was carefully scripted or if that was a moment of pure improvisation.
It wasn't pure improvisation. It was definitely on the page. We just kind of had to make it light and natural. And then if something happens to come out your mouth, then if it fits, they keep it. You know what I mean? But my character, I got to paint these labels on these jars. So I ain't got time to get up and dance around. But I will sing the song a little bit. So, yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Queen Latifah, thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, thanks
for spending time
with
us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Terrence Howard came into our studios the other day. He actually began as a singer and songwriter and got sort of sidetracked into acting, where he's won accolades and fame in films that include Hustle and Flow and Crash. Now, at the age of 39, he's put out his first CD. It's called Shine Through It, and here's a taste.
Sentimental phone calls. People hide. Behind, how you doing? Then the talk stalls. How come you never found love through it?
Mr. Howard looked every inch a movie star, but in the classic sense, wearing a soft fedora cocked Sinatra style, like a man who still feels that a star should dress the part, not dress down to avoid being recognized. And he was in a mood to talk about music, acting, and loss. Terrence Howard's mother died just 2 weeks ago, and he cherishes the debt he owes his great-grandmother, Minnie Gentry, the stage actress he used to watch from the wings of theaters.
She introduced me to acting because there was magic and believability in what she did. She would make me sit down at the piano and would teach me the relationship between A and D and G and C, why they were best friends. Why they were relatives. You know, she talked to me about music in terms of a family. So it's become part of my family.
Well, what did you see come over her when she was on stage, she was performing, that fascinated you?
It was as if watching the glaciers move, not retreat, but advance. You know, when she was in the process of becoming a character, because she was this foundation. But she would allow herself to break and would make no excuses for it, you know. And some actors are so busy trying to look good at all times that they stop being good.
Do you mind if I ask about your childhood?
Yeah, you can.
You You read about it.
Yeah.
You had a tough childhood.
I've lived. I have lived. And they say experience is the name that we give to our mistakes along the way. Some things you're forced to experience that you didn't choose to. But it's how you recover from them. You know, I grew up in the same environment where a lot of the kids ended up going to jail, you know, or getting hooked on drugs. You know, lived in the same projects as a result of it, as a result of what happened with my father.
Can we explain that? Your father went to prison.
Yeah. My father went to prison for 11 months, which moved us from being middle class, upper middle class, to living in the projects. You know, my father was hated because of, he was accused of murdering a white guy at a time when the nation was already racially divided. My father came back from prison a different person because the kind nature he had to lose in order to survive prison. Yeah. He came out and we became Muslims. And we were young, beautifully mixed children put into a very bad neighborhood that at the time it wasn't appreciated to be light-skinned with green eyes. And, you know, my mom would sing to us and tell us it was okay when we get beat up or something. My father would try and teach us to fight.
Do you remember what your mother sang to you to comfort you? I wonder.
She said, "This too shall pass." Yeah. My mom passed 2 weeks ago.
Which,
it's interesting because now that energy that motivated her life will go to the thing that's most like her life. And this was her dream, to be an actor and a musician. My dream was to be a physicist.
Yeah.
So I have to think that some part of her is animating me.
I have to ask about an announcement that came out recently. You're not going to be Jim Rhodes in Iron Man 2.
Yeah, I found that out too.
Really? They didn't.
It was the surprise of a lifetime. There was no explanation. Just up and vanish, and I read something in the trades that that implicated it was about money or something. But apparently, the contracts that we write and sign aren't worth the paper that they're printed on sometimes. And promises aren't kept, and good faith negotiations aren't always held up. You know, even friendships, people that you support, you know. And I found a peacefulness in me, though, that even in getting slapped when I was a little kid, when I would get attacked, even though I was strong enough to stop it, I would never hit back then. I didn't start hitting back till I was 15. I didn't stop hitting back until I was around 28. Even now, I didn't hit back. So it reminded me that, wow, I'm back to the peacefulness that I had before.
We're talking with Terrence Howard, actor, musician, and occasional carpenter. With all those skills, I suggested he wouldn't be between jobs for very long.
Nah, because there's some other construction that needs to be done. So.
I was going to ask, what, you know, when your next kitchen is, or whatever you're doing.
Yeah. Well, no, the next thing we're doing, we're building a pond, 110-foot pond in front of our house in Plymouth Meeting, and we're putting these huge stones, like 2-ton stones a piece, in there as the base of it. And my son is learning to operate a Skytrak and a crane at 13 years old, and tell a lady watching him go in and out and pick up a stone that could crush both him and me and our car, and maneuver that, and trusting him.
Yeah.
And I'm raising a really beautiful young man that will probably become the scientist I always wanted to become.
What if he comes to you one day and says, "Dad, I really want to be in show business"?
I would prefer him not to.
Yeah.
Just because, as an actor, the saddest thing, you stop experiencing moments. You start watching them as if you're storing them for future reference.
So, for example, you see somebody
make a face on a bus or have an emotional moment, you store it away.
Yeah, it's like when I was sitting there with my mother at home for the last 2 weeks, there were moments when I couldn't turn the actor off that was watching her, you know, and wondering what was going through her mind, but also wondering, oh, so that's what that emotion is like. That's what it's like to be facing death, to be this close to it. There's a stillness there. And trying to stop myself and her looking up and saying, what are you thinking? And I was telling her, I was trying to see what you're thinking. You know, but she's always known me and known me to be a curious person. But the actor sometimes takes over in places that you don't want it there. Maybe I was just afraid to face the emotion that was happening. So
it could be you fell back on the actor.
I began to watch. You know, I feel a bit like Dorian Gray at times because I don't necessarily see, I don't know, I don't see the pain of life as much because I've played so many characters. And I think that's what happens to a lot of actors, you know, and therefore they get hooked in drugs because they're desperate to get away from not feeling. Mm-hmm. They want to be excited or something. I don't know. It's a very strange thing, so I guess I still would stir them away from it.
But could it be that it, by the way, that's one of the most extraordinary things I've ever heard. The, like, clearest, most lucid, most affecting explanation I think I've ever heard as to why some people are actors. Now, do you think that the sidetrack that you took through the movie business and stage to get back to music, do you think you, I mean, God willing, we learn something from everything, but do you think you learned something as an actor that refreshes your music now?
Yeah. I mean, when I first started acting, I thought it was about the best liar. I thought the best liar was the best actor. Mm-hmm. But it's the best truth teller. To find the truth on those pages of black and white and to believe in it so much, it has to be honest. It has to be truthful.
We're speaking with Terrence Howard about his acting and music. But as a child, his first fascination was with science.
I got to looking at a bubble when I was a kid. And I remember blowing it. I was sitting in front of my house, 3200 Central Avenue in Cleveland. And I blew a bubble. And I said, why does a bubble take the shape of a ball? Why not a square or a triangle? And I went in search of that answer. And people kept saying it was the most economical shape for holding something. And you learn, and if I can elaborate.
Please, come, because I'm dying to know the answer.
Wow.
I don't think I figured it out ever. Yeah.
It turns out once the pressure is equalized in the center of a bubble, the strongest thing exerting force on it is the weight of the universe pushing down equally upon all points. You follow those points out to the edge of the universe, you have the shape of the universe. But someone would say the universe is infinite.
Yeah.
But that violates an object must be equal to the sum of its parts. And if the universe is made up, if everything inside of it has a shape and has a boundary, and then the universe is made up of these finite particles, it must be bound by the very last particle. And at 13, I said, wow, the universe is finite, and I can prove it.
May I ask finally, are you, for a lot of different reasons, I guess we've talked about here, are you at a point in your life where you realize that life, like the universe, is finite?
Yes. I did some math a couple of days ago. Mm-hmm. And I said, there's 6 billion human beings on this planet. In our galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy, 600 quadrillion miles across, there's over 100 billion stars. If you were to take each human being on this planet and put them in a different star system within our very own galaxy, there would still be 94 billion star systems unoccupied. Life is extremely precious, and that's why it's passed down from mother and father, and it takes two to make one. That's how powerful and precious life is.
You can hear an extended version of our interview with Terrence Howard on our website, npr.org, and I hope you will. He has continually fascinating insights into acting, music, science, and all the ways they come together. And we have a video excerpt from that interview, too, on our blog at npr.org/soapbox. Mr. Howard is simply riveting.
Oliver Stone has taken on American presidents before, with the conspiracies and darkness of JFK and Nixon. In his latest movie, he paints a picture of a presidency that hasn't ended yet. W is Oliver Stone's version of how President George W. Bush came to power and went to war. With such an overtly political filmmaker, it's easy to assume that Stone simply skewered the 43rd president.
He is a bully. Got a huge ego, as you can see. He keeps saying, I'm the decider, I make the decisions. And he doesn't seem to have much intellectual curiosity. He doesn't seem to have read a lot.
Okay, so Oliver Stone personally has almost nothing nice to say about the president, but he has real empathy for the main character of his film. There's the sweet romance with Laura Bush, the president's deep religious conviction, the burden of having a too perfect father with too low expectations for his son. W offers familiar moments in the life of George W. Bush, including glimpses of vulnerability.
Mr. President, after 9/11, what would you say your biggest mistakes would be, and what lessons have you learned from them?
I wish you would have given me this written question beforehand, John, so I could prepare for it. John, I'm sure historians will say, gosh, you know, I wish he could have done better, you know, this way or that way.
W is certainly not a flattering portrait, but Oliver Stone emphasizes it's culled from numerous factual accounts.
There's not one movie in Bush. You can make three movies. The truth is, you know, what kind of man is he? What's the mindset? At first, he comes on as a simplistic, black and white guy, and then as you go through the movie, the idea was back and forth. You'd understand with an understanding, with a dramatist's understanding. You'd walk in his shoes. My politics may not be his, but as a dramatist, I do try to be unbiased, and many people have said fair. I've been fair to the man.
There is a scene where the young George W. Bush is pledging a fraternity at Yale, and he's in the midst of a kind of a hazing, and it's pretty nasty stuff. They're being, you know, being forced to drink tons of alcohol and what. And he ends up using what appears to be a special political talent, and that's he can name all the fraternity members in the room.
Yes, that's a true story. Bush had an amazing quality, even then, as a young man, to remember what mattered, which was politics and personality and popularity. And he actually named 50 members of the DKE fraternity at Yale. As I said, born politician, born salesman.
I gather you wouldn't have been pledging any of those fraternities while you were at Yale at the same time that George W. Bush was.
Yeah, I was in the class of 68, but I didn't make it. There was a whole new breed of people that were not interested in fraternities. So there was a change. There was a great period of change at that time. But Bush was a throwback, and he came from an entitled family. And that's another thing about George Bush. He never really, when you talk about intellectually, he never questioned his roots. He always went the family road in terms of politics, you know.
There's been much made of the Oedipal issues between the two presidents, Bush, generally, out there. You chose this father-son relationship as one of the major ways of getting into his story. And one of the things that you carry it through as part of the story is George W. Bush's desire to finish, it would seem, the driving out of Saddam Hussein that his father, for
That's
many good reasons, didn't.
Yeah. Well, remember, the film is presented in a context. You see, for example, the father's defeat in 1992 to Clinton, and how astounding that was to the Bush family. And Bush Jr., by all accounts, took it very personally, hated Clinton, hated the whole thing, hated the concept of losing, very competitive. So we get a situation where the son bypasses the father in 92. After the father loses, the father retires from public office, and now the son becomes governor. Very interesting situation.
You know, if one were to look up Bush quotes, which we did on the web, you can put together the quotes you can find very easily on the web and come up with a few scenes in your movie.
I mean, there you go. You fool me once, shame on you.
Now fool me twice and you can't get fooled again.
Oh, there's so many. I mean, this man is awkward and he's goofy and he's not very good with the English language, but Americans like him for that, you know. We had quite a bit of fun with it, but, you know, it's not the... We didn't set out to do a parody. That wouldn't have worked for 2 hours. It's a real character, and Josh Brolin doesn't overdo it. And sometimes you're laughing... Really, you're laughing at him through the movie, but at the end of the day, it comes down to, you know, how did we elect this man? Who was he? How did we get here? Where are we going?
I don't believe he's seen it, but Karl Rove has told the New York Times, and I'll quote him, "I don't think they made any attempt to have this conform to any reality except that which exists in the cerebral cortex of Oliver Stone." The opinion of Karl Rove.
Well, you know, he joins a long list of people who have attacked me without having seen my movies, by which I mean Richard Nixon really had at me on JFK, although I know he never saw the movie. George Bush Sr. attacked me on, I think it was JFK, yep. This is a nice long tradition of people who do not choose to see the movie.
You know, I just have one last question, and that is, you know, seeing George W. Bush as a human being, flawed though he may be, on screen in your film, what does the audience walk away with?
Well, you know, I mean, at the most basic level, I guess, you know, you'd say, wow, you know, I never knew the guy that way. I only heard this, I heard that, but I never understood what he went through. Now I understand how he got there. But here it explains the steps, the ways of the cross.
Yeah, when you say steps, you mean somehow living through it, in a sense.
Yeah.
Because so much of it in this film is we know.
Yeah. You know, why did the ancient Greeks go to these crazy theaters to watch things like Oedipus? You know, a guy who is blind, who doesn't acknowledge anything until the very, very end of the play when he goes crazy, practically, because he realizes he killed his father and he made love to his mother. I mean... Why would we go see a movie like that? Why would we go see a play like that? It has nothing to do with my life, you think. Well, you may be wrong. And when I made the Bush thing, I have to say, I hope humility, that there are many things in Bush that I have in myself, and I think we all do. I mean, there is arrogance, and everyone thinks he's the good guy of his life. We all create this narrative where we wake up and, you know, you're Renee, I'm Oliver, we try to do good every day. I think George wakes up the same way, bringing good to the world. He doesn't see the bad. Same is true for all of us.
Director Oliver Stone, his movie W, opens today. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Back now with Day to Day and the line that has come to define Wall Street.
The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good.
Michael Douglas won an Oscar for his portrayal of the ruthless corporate raider Gordon Gekko in the film Wall Street. The movie came out 21 years ago, but its message about the perils of the stock market may be especially relevant today. Day to Day's Alex Cohen has more.
Screenwriter Stanley Weiser is quick to point out the movie Wall Street almost didn't happen.
It was just a fluke.
In 1986, director Oliver Stone asked him to write a movie about the quiz show scandals of the 1950s. But then Stone started taking note of current events.
And there were a lot of insider trading scandals that had come to light and were unfolding. And he decided he knew that was the more important issue. And he told me to go off and work on that instead.
Weiser knew little about the financial world, so he went to Wall Street and spent time with brokers. He read up on all the big players, and he came up with the character of Gordon Gekko.
I create nothing. I own. We make the rules, pal.
In the film, Gordon Gekko takes a young trader named Bud Fox under his wing. He quickly teaches Fox, played by Charlie Sheen, about the illusions of the stock market.
How much is enough?
It's not a question of enough, pal. It's a zero-sum game. Somebody wins, somebody loses.
With a few ethically risky moves, Fox quickly makes plenty of money. In true 80s style, he spends it on sushi parties and a lavish Manhattan apartment. Watching it now, the film seems really dated. The huge hairdos, the cheesy music, the mobile phones the size of Long Island. But, says writer Stanley Weiser, some themes of the film are timeless.
In 1989, the cover of Newsweek said the greed decade is over. The Gordon Gekkos of the world are all gone. How absurd that is, because It's the same.
Weiser sees plenty of parallels between the corporate takeovers of his movie and the subprime mortgages lurking behind the current financial crisis.
They were looking for ways of more. And junk bonds were dead, and corporate takeovers were dead. So it's like people have to come up with some kind of new Ponzi scheme.
There are days when Stanley Weiser wonders if his words, in some small way, are partly to blame.
Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed.
Over the years, I would run into people who would tell me how much that movie meant to them, but it meant to them for the wrong reasons.
Weiser cringes each time someone says they want to be just like Gordon Gekko.
I realized at that point that I had succeeded with the movie, but I also failed by sending the wrong message.
He says those who see Gekko as a hero are missing the point. In the end of the film Wall Street, greed got everyone in trouble. Greed sent people to jail. Greed ruined people's lives. But greed, it would seem, also entertains. Variety reports that 20th Century Fox is planning a Wall Street sequel, which focuses on the life of Gordon Gekko after he gets out of jail. Alex Cohen, NPR News.
For more about these and other movies, visit our website, npr.org/movies.